If Scientology is properly studied and applied and one does not have unrealistic expectations, one can learn a considerable amount about oneself and how to interface with the universe. This includes a reconciliation of one's past lives and complete freedom from mental and emotional impediments. It is also not uncommon for Scientologists to cure themselves of chronic physical conditions or to awaken paranormal abilities. Scientology also offers valid drug rehabilitation and teaches basic reading skills plus a host of many other things. The politics of the organization were always designed to be separate from the procedural technology employed by the organization. The entire goal of Scientology processing, also called auditing or counseling, is to raise a person's tone, which refers to their emotional character or quality, and to free them spiritually. It is approached on a gradient scale so that under ideal conditions, one starts out achieving a little and ends up reaching for the sun, moon and stars. In my first year in Scientology, I experienced telepathy, psychic premonitions and even a complete out-of-body experience with full visual perception. A few months later, I had joined L. Ron Hubbard's Elite Sea organization, which was totally dedicated to establishing high-functioning Dianetics and Scientology organizations across the planet. High-functioning meant that there would be no adversity with the press, public or anyone else. It was understood that Scientology, properly applied, would alleviate any such bad karma. After 1 month in that organization, I found myself on an airplane headed to an unknown destination. I would report to an apartment in Madrid and from there be prepared for a rendezvous with the yacht Apollo, the home and research center of L. Ron Hubbard. It was all very James Bondish. From Madrid, I was put on a plane to Casablanca in Morocco, where I boarded the ship longer than a football field that housed 350, 400 people. Hubbard was a relentless worker and didn't meet with the various individuals who came aboard. A guide was assigned to me after I boarded, and he gave me a complete tour of the ship. I got several glimpses of Hubbard. One of the first questions I asked my guide was if they ever encountered any UFOs while they were sailing. He was a former Buckingham Palace guard and was very meticulous about his answers. Having been aboard the ship practically since its inception, he carefully scanned his memory. "Only once," he said. "One time at sea, someone on the bridge had spotted a couple of flying saucers in the night sky." He turned to the Commodore, referring to Hubbard, and asked if he saw what was in the sky. He said that Hubbard shot back immediately without any hesitation and said, "Flying them quite badly, aren't they?" Hubbard was quick like that and his range of perception was wide. One heard countless anecdotes like this when aboard the ship, but no one collected them for posterity. Critics of Scientology have always blasted the biographical PR sheets put out on Hubbard by the church and have accused them of being inflated with non-existent heroics. Actually, the stories reported by the crew on an offhand basis were far more interesting than idealized PR broadsheets and would probably have alleviated the critics to a marked degree, if they believed them. After boarding the Apollo, I soon had an encounter with Hubbard which probably ranks as the most bizarre experience of my life. Like most new people, I was assigned to the decks and found myself scraping rust not too far away from Hubbard's research room. He snuck up behind me and began skull-watching. This referred to him walking around the decks and looking inside people's heads. I sort of knew he was there, but I froze mentally and continued to work. He watched me for some time. His presence was hard to miss. I don't know exactly what happened next, but I experienced missing time. It is very hard to describe, but I will try. It was as if I were in two places at once. There seemed to be a numbness that was blocking my full perception of the circumstances. This was followed by a tremendous brightness and lightness of being. I was elsewhere. Slowly, the idea began to occur to me that I had a distant connection to a body scraping rust. I simply couldn't account for what was happening, but I found myself determined not to turn around. I then heard Hubbard talking with my boss, who was working on the sun deck above me. I continued to work. I was still very distant and my consciousness was barely in the physical plane at all. Not until Hubbard left my vicinity did I turn around and see him walking away. Although I spoke of this incident with a few friends, I never said too much about this experience. It was all rather puzzling. Looking back on what occurred, Hubbard loved to send people out of their bodies if he could. This was sort of a personal passion, and in some respects, he considered it his major value to mankind. He was known to have pierced the veil of the physical plane. In my particular case, I feel there was some sort of subtle transmission or communication going on, which will be explained later on. Hubbard was not only peering into my psyche but was apparently viewing my potential role in the scheme of things. He was obviously not threatened by me, or he would have had me scurried off the ship in short order. Although it was all rather strange, it was not a traumatic or horrific experience but just something I could not reconcile until many years later. Chapter 28, Through the Vortex. After the missing time experience, my encounters or interactions with Hubbard were of a normal nature, for the most part. I had to learn to recognize him as a human being, and I think that was a struggle for many crew members. There was certainly no way I could easily deal with his own energetic fields. They were tremendously strong and far beyond my reality at the time. My next 10 years were spent intently studying and applying Scientology to myself and others. They also included working for Hubbard and studying his personal history and behavior patterns as best I could. I didn't think anyone who worked closely with him considered for 1 minute that he was like everyone else. I was interested in what made him tick and watched his actions closely. To make a long story short, let me just say that I had all sorts of wonderful experiences, including what Hubbard termed the state of clear. Beyond that are the upper levels of Scientology, which were called operating thi. Ot I, Ot 2 inches and Ot 3 inches stood for different levels one could achieve. The word thi was the Scientology word for spirit, thi being derived from theta, the Greek letter which also designates life or life force. With regard to these upper levels, I want to point out something I feel is very important and more than ironic. From time to time, the media has had a field day with the upper levels of Scientology. The Church of Scientology considers them sacred scripture and that they should remain confidential to the general public and their own parishioners until such time that these individuals are ready to receive them. Both ABC's Nightline and the Los Angeles Times have blurted this information to the public and have relayed it in a most uncomplimentary fashion. They have reduced the information and transmuted it into a lower form that makes it appear utterly absurd and ridiculous. Scientologists would tell you that it is presented totally out of context. Without adding my own opinion as to the relative truth of this information, I can assure you that the Scientologists are correct in this manner. It has been presented in a fashion that is out of context with what Scientologists believe and practice. If you study books that are critical about Scientology, you can read different reports on and transcripts of these upper levels. According to this information, Ot 3 inches is considered to be one of the heaviest levels, which deals with lifting a series of implants that have been layered into spiritual beings on a wholesale basis. All of these implants are traced back to a major implant that all spiritual beings have suffered, which goes back some 4 quadrillion years. This implant consisted of a series of loud snapping noises with a cherub blowing a horn, coming close and fading away. Not too much is said about it other than it was the beginning of time. Those who are familiar with the Bible will recognize that cherubs guarded the gate to the Garden of Eden. Hubbard had apparently discovered a route back to the Garden of Eden, which Preston Nichols has identified as the original timeline. People who did this level in Scientology were not supposed or expected to move lock, stock and barrel out of this dimension. They would generally feel as if they had left tons of spiritual garbage behind and would have a deep and penetrating awareness of their spiritual nature and perhaps what could possibly be called the original timeline. After that point, the game for most of these individuals became to help others to experience it. In my personal experience with this level, I also found that the principle of synchronicity kicked into a remarkable degree. Things began to happen that made sense, although they might make no sense at all to others. There is too much detail that is precarious to explain, But let's just say that I had some major illuminations as a result of my Scientology experiences. All of this came to a head in 1982 when I was living on Cleveland Street in Clearwater, Florida. I was probably doing the best I had ever done spiritually and had reached a level where I discovered that anything I willed could happen. This sounds rather presumptuous, and I soon found there were limitations to what I could manifest. Even so, there was a lot I could will to happen. I observed that what impeded the will and the well-being of myself and others was the entire physical materialism that this universe is embedded with. By this, I do not mean the philosophy of materialism but the actual physics of this universe and how it is constructed. I mean, wouldn't it be nice if you could make an auto accident erase itself? Although miracles and remarkable things can occur in nature, willing an auto accident the way that has already occurred is not too easy. I was feeling very good one day in 1982 and felt there were no considerations of limitations in my subjective universe. I dug very deeply and accessed those thoughts in my own psyche which were holding me to this physical plane. Underneath those were a matrix of thoughts which belonged to all forms of consciousness. This deeper layer of thoughts could be said to hold the entire constructs of the physical universe together. I then went poof, so to speak, and willed the entire dissolving or unraveling of the physical universe. It was my day off, and I then went about my business with no more thought about what I had decided with regard to the grander scheme in the cosmos. It was all very matter of fact. Only a matter of hours later, I was standing in a parking lot off Cleveland Street and noticed a big electrical explosion in the sky. It was much like fireworks, but it was very quick and completely bizarre. The first thing I said to myself was that I knew that something had occurred and there was no way I would go into denial over what I saw. The typical human reaction in our culture would be to deny it. I looked around and saw a huge antenna structure near the GTE building. I wondered if there was a relationship. Once again, I experienced the phenomena of missing time. It was all very odd. A short while later, I saw a Chinese girl I knew and told her I saw something very weird over in that direction. She validated what I saw by saying that strange things occurred in that direction all the time. I spoke about it to a few other friends, but that was about it. It would take me years to figure out what had actually happened. My life circumstances began to change dramatically. I was 29, which astrologers will recognize as a major time for change with regard to the 29-year cycle of the planet Saturn. I got married, deftly eased out of my Scientology career and ended up moving to Long Island just weeks before the culmination of the Montauk Project on August 12, 1983. Years later, I returned to Clearwater to visit some of my old friends. After a game of football, I saw the antenna tower I had recognized years earlier. Pointing to the area, I told my friend, Claude Hensley, that was the location where I had seen an explosion years ago. He already knew the story, and as he was driving, I asked if we could take a look. As soon as we got to a vacant lot under which I deemed the explosion to have occurred, Claude made a comment that he had seen a UFO there once. I had no idea he had ever seen a UFO of any kind. It took years before I could get any kind of answer to the mystery behind the explosion and the missing time. Chapter 29, The Secret of Excalibur. After moving to New York in 1983, I began to live a new life. Although the Montauk Project was at its peak, I was oblivious to it. I had been seeking spiritual truth for some 12 years and it was now time to carve out a physical existence. My wife and I were newlyweds and were planning on a family. This would require work, paying bills, etc. After 1 week in New York, I noticed that my psychic sensibilities were practically nil. I attributed it to the materialism that is so prevalent in the area. I had no idea that transmissions from Montauk could be jamming me and anyone else in the vicinity of Long Island. As I moved through various career activities, I slowly began to renew my study of spiritual matters. A defamatory book entitled L. Ron Hubbard, Messiah or Madman? Caught my curiosity. It mentioned Hubbard's admiration of and interest in Aleister Crowley, the self-proclaimed beast who was known as the wickedest man in the world. This book was written by a man, Bent Corydon, who had an obvious axe to grind, and I felt that everything said about Crowley and Hubbard was designed to alienate people from the subject. It did just the opposite for me. I began to seek out anything I could find on Crowley, including the Book of the Law, which is reported to be a communication from an extraterrestrial source. While pursuing Crowley's literature, I came across an old manuscript of Hubbard's that I identified as his last work, Excalibur. This was a book that was quite legendary in Scientology. It was supposedly written in the late 1930s, long before Dianetics. It was said to contain the keys to life and death itself. There was a persistent story in circulation that the first few people who read it had died. At that point, Hubbard had supposedly withdrawn it from circulation. When people asked about this book during my tenure, Hubbard always claimed that the manuscript of this work had been lost or stolen many years ago. There was no particular reason to believe he was saying anything other than the truth. In around 1979, a major project had begun to dig deeply into Hubbard's past for the purpose of a laudatory biography. A lot of interesting information was retrieved from his personal archives and from across the United States. Much to everyone's surprise, the book Excalibur turned up. Hubbard was reported to be surprised as well. The legends surrounding this book are strange. One person has Hubbard saying the idea was a joke and that no such book was ever written. Apparently, in the early days of Dianetics, he ran an ad offering it for thousands of dollars a copy. One didn't know if he was stroking the market and creating intrigue or if he was really just offering the book for an astronomical price. Other accounts have him actually writing the book. When he repeatedly said that the manuscript was lost or stolen, he specifically mentioned the manuscript and not necessarily the hard-bound book. Another legend said that only a handful of books were ever printed. Upon examining all available reports concerning the book Excalibur, it seems that a terrific smokescreen was created. I personally knew the book existed because one of my old football buddies had seen it and had occasion to read it. He said that it was a thin hard-bound book and that much of the information was in existing Scientology literature. It definitely existed. He also said that the book was taken out of his hands by a person who later turned on Hubbard and had been in charge of Hubbard's biography project. This particular person was apparently quite upset that my friend had seen the book. The manuscript I found was not entitled Excalibur but did fit the exact description of what my friend had described, except that it was not in a hard-bound condition. It had been written on a typewriter. It became obvious to me that if this book was not Excalibur, it at least contained some of the same information. After discovering this manuscript and glancing through it, I became charged with energy, but I didn't notice it until later in the day when I was in a park. I hadn't even read the manuscript at that point but had only photocopied it. I only remember feeling extremely confident that I was on the right track. Perhaps I had tapped some of the supreme confidence that Hubbard used to manifest, but I can assure you I was nowhere near his level in that department. There was no missing time associated with the surge in energy, but I did wake up the next morning in my friend's house and it took me several minutes to figure out where I was. This was rather odd as I was familiar with his house and had slept there on several occasions. There is a logical explanation for what happened. As already said, part of the book contained regular information from Dianetics and Scientology, but it was put together in what I considered to be a refreshing and new format. Actually, it was a very old manuscript. Of considerably more interest to me were a long series of geometric symbols that were designed to unlock the conscious mind. I had absolutely no idea what these were about, and although I had studied most everything Hubbard had written, I had never seen anything like the procedures he was outlining. For those of you who have read Pyramids of Montauk, you will recognize the importance of geometric symbols. They have been used by different mystery schools, including the Pythagorean system, to invoke a fourth-dimensional experience. The idea is that if you take a two-dimensional symbol and convert it into a third-dimensional one, you can access the fourth dimension, if you are lucky. This is what mandalas and even some Renaissance paintings are about. This is what the editor, who could have been none other than Hubbard, had to say about it. Symbols have often been used hopefully in an effort to unlock the unconscious mind and derive some answer to its terrible power over man. The use of symbols is not new. Their employment with these evaluation techniques is new, for here they are solidly backed by an understanding of what the unconscious may be expected to contain. He further went on to say that symbols are not a thing in themselves but are a code form that can be used to discover reality. It was also pointed out that such symbols vary widely from individual to individual. There were different procedures to use with the symbols, the first of which was simply reviewing them. Perhaps the download of energy I experienced could be explained not only by the fact that I reviewed the symbols, but I actually drew them one by one so as to have a record. I was trying to save on copy machine costs, as there were many symbols and there was usually one symbol per page. At the time, I had no idea I would be writing books and doing future research. A further explanation as to how all of this impacted my consciousness is offered by the word Excalibur and circumstances surrounding it in my own life. I have not told you that one of the Scientology ships I worked on for 2 years was named Excalibur. I still remember the day I told one of the staff Scientologists from my hometown that I was going to be working on a ship by the name of Excalibur. He smiled and said, "That makes perfect sense. Why?" I said. "I heard that Ron used to be King Arthur," he replied. Excalibur, of course, was the sword of King Arthur, and that was the connection this Scientologist was making. I never heard Hubbard say that he was King Arthur, but I know he could easily have identified with such a flamboyant figure. After all, he was from Celtic stock and named his youngest son Arthur. Hubbard's greatest gift was his ability to tap the unconscious and the power associated with it. That is exactly what happened when he snuck up behind me and I was unable to move. He was playing with unconscious forces that were invisible to me at the time, and I don't mean to imply that he was goofing around. It is ridiculous to think that a being like Hubbard, whether you think he is good or bad, would exclusively communicate in just ordinary human terms. Not even Hubbard's most severe critics will deny that he wielded considerable power. We are offered a clue to this power if we examine the etymology and accompanying legend of King Arthur's sword Excalibur. Excal is a transposition of the Latin calx, which means limestone. The English word calyx means an outer covering. Do you know what has an outer covering consisting of limestone? The Great Pyramid of Giza. At least it did before it was defaced over time. The root cal refers to measurement and is seen in words like calculus, calculator and calendar. If an outsider were to examine our language, they could easily get the idea that all measuring sciences in our culture were originally inspired by the Great Pyramid. Even the word California derives from a Spanish word for a fabled island. This was supposedly a Lemurian island with pyramids. There is also an Arabic word Caliph, which is used to designate the successor to the Prophet in the Islamic religion. Etymologically, giving someone the title of Caliph is tantamount to calling him master of the Great Pyramid. The suffix bur refers to burn or light. This all clarifies even more when we consider the Gaelic root for Excalibur, which is Caliburnus. This simply means fire in the pyramid or fire in time, Kali referring to Kali, the Hindu goddess of time. See Pyramids of Montauk for more information on the secrets of the Great Pyramid. According to the legends of King Arthur, Excalibur was a double-edged sword embedded in a stone known as the Philosopher's Stone. It could only be withdrawn by King Arthur himself. Although the sword was embedded in the stone, it originated from the lady in a lake. It is interesting to note that Hubbard's magical partner, Jack Parsons, is the author of one published book entitled Freedom is a Two-Edged Sword. The Philosopher's Stone is a well-known alchemical symbol. It represents the capstone of the Great Pyramid, which contains the total science of Atlantis. The capstone was never found and is one of those historical mysteries. Occult history tells us that it dissolved and could no longer be activated, eventually becoming a fourth-dimensional umbrella around the Van Allen belt. In the Middle Ages, this umbrella was tapped into by various forms of consciousness and manifested as the legends of King Arthur. It is also sometimes known as Grail Christianity. The story of Arthur is indeed the story of Teuti Orthoth, the builder of the Great Pyramid. Christ consciousness is the software that enables us to access Tao-Te's gift, which is a super science beyond our imagination and gives us the ability to transform the planet. If we are smart, we will use this super science to access the original timeline, not go off in lost or selfish directions. One other aspect concerning Tao-Te should be mentioned here. He was known to the Greeks as Hermes and to the Romans as Mercury. His mother was Maia, the most resplendent of the Pleiades, who were seven goddesses in Greek mythology who became stars. We will delve further into the mythological significance of the Pleiades in the latter portion of this book. Although King Arthur was the only one who could draw the sword Excalibur from the stone, it is meant to represent a tool that anyone can use. The secret of the sword lies in the lake. Excalibur is a secret encodement of the feminine force and how to use it. That the Lady of the Lake is in the lake, water represents the feminine, tells us that the secret lies in the feminine force. This is Tao-Te's gift. It is the gift of the goddess. This explains the secret access of L. Ron Hubbard. Although it is not popularly known, he wrote his work in a trance-like state and received his inspiration from a goddess he called the Empress. There is another interesting aspect to the sword Excalibur. Earlier, I indicated that cherubs stood at the entrance to the Garden of Eden. The Bible also mentions that they were accompanied by a flaming sword which turned every way. If Excalibur represents the secret of the feminine energy, this passage is telling us that this is the secret of returning to the original timeline. Chapter 30, Missing Links. While pursuing Excalibur, I had been staying with a friend who had Aldous Huxley's The Doors of Perception in his bookcase. Huxley was an interesting character who had networked with Hubbard and was even regressed by him in the 1950s. He had received an initiation and a lot of information from Aleister Crowley. Huxley also spoon-fed information to Timothy Leary on exactly how to administer LSD to his experimental subjects at Harvard. The Doors of Perception is a book about accessing those regions of the mind considered a vast unknown to conventional science. The primary avenue Huxley experimented with in this book was mescaline, a derivative from the peyote cactus. He also mentioned other undesirable avenues such as fasting to the point of starvation and self-flagellation. The only path that made any sense was sensory deprivation as could be experienced in a flotation tank. This sounded interesting, but I couldn't find one. In fact, the search became rather frustrating. I continued to study the work of Aleister Crowley in conjunction with the resonant properties of crystals. In August of 1990, I bought a couple of large quartz crystals. I would later find out that August is the time period the Egyptians called the Sirius transmissions. In other words, this is when the occult link between the Earth and the star Sirius is at its peak. I don't know if the Sirius transmissions were helping me via the crystals, but after I bought them and placed them in my house, I finally found what I had been looking for, a flotation tank. Not only had I found a tank on Long Island, but its owner was the manufacturer of the most modern and desirable flotation tank available. There was also an interesting and tragic tale he had to tell, but first I will talk about floating. The tank was very user-friendly and had a contour like a whale. There was plenty of room inside with two waterproof switches for lights and music. The water is hygienically filtered and loaded with Epsom salt so that your body is completely suspended in water and completely relaxed. It is impossible to physically relax all your muscles to the extent you can while floating. Subluxations even disappeared through total relaxation. As the tank is totally dark, your mind begins to process information until it finally relaxes and penetrates the deeper layers of consciousness. I not only found it to be extremely fun, but it also opened up psychic channels of the mind. At the very least, it relaxes one's body. I soon realized that if people floated every day, there would be a lot less strife in the world and a great deal more productivity. This is where the tragic tale comes into play. The man who manufactures these tanks is Peter Shepard. He told me that he used to have a large factory in Babylon and he had begun producing flotation tanks at a rapid clip. Suddenly, a few short weeks before a fire destroyed his facility, his insurance policy was arbitrarily cancelled. The source of the fire was found to be lightning. I told him this sounded like a conspiracy, even though I didn't know at the time that lightning could be manufactured. He had wondered about it himself as well as the whole karma of the situation. The only thing he could do was institute a lawsuit against the insurance company. Although he suffered severe losses and had to cut back his productivity, he continues to manufacture flotation tanks today. The reason there would be a conspiracy against floating is that it raises your consciousness.